This is Alan Minsky with Melisa Figueroa, and we're sitting in for Margaret Prescott today. And this is the final installment of Building a Powerful Left in the United States from the Left Forum in New York City. On today's show, we're going to start out hearing from Egyptian activist Mustafa Omar, his thoughts, more than a month after the uprising in Tahrir Square. And then we're going to turn to the central theme of these shows, about building a powerful left in the United States. And we'll hear thoughts on the subject from geographer and Marxist scholar David Harvey, Barbara Epstein, a professor in the History of Consciousness program at the University of Santa Cruz, and Glenn Ford, the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. And then we'll hear an excerpt from Madison, Wisconsin's own John Nichols, and an excerpt of his speech at the closing plenary of the Left Forum 2011. But we begin our show talking with Mustafa Omar about the Egyptian revolution moving forward. This is Alan Minsky, and I'm at the Left Forum in New York City, and I'm joined by Mustafa Omar, who is an Egyptian activist who was in Cairo and Tahrir Square when Hosni Mubarak resigned. We're now talking on March 20th, 2011. We're ways past Mubarak's resignation, about a month and a half past the time he resigned. Your sense of the trajectory of events in Egypt?
I think that the sense of worry has existed since the very first days after Mubarak resigned. It actually goes up and down every week. Sometimes people have a bad week. They're not getting their demands met. People start to worry the next week out of the blue. New rounds of mass struggles break out. You take down the state security forces, the secret police. You bring down the Mubarak government. And actually people's expectations, you know, and confidence, level of confidence goes up. But once again, while the Mubarak is gone, most of the regime is still in power in governors, in municipalities, and is organizing an intense campaign to slow down the tempo of the revolution. So you will see a lot of these back and forth, people feeling that they're accomplishing and they're moving forward, and then there will be setbacks. But generally speaking, in terms of the trajectory, overall, although many of the revolution's demands have not yet been met, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which rules Egypt, has made serious concessions that have actually raised people's expectations. They've dismissed Mubarak's government, they've dismantled the secret police, they've appointed a prime minister who actually took part in the Tahrir demonstrations, and generally speaking, I think people feel that even if the constitutional amendments pass as the army wants, that it's not the end of the story, that there are more rounds of struggle, and you can actually still put tremendous amount of pressure on the Supreme Council and you can win.
There was a strong economic component to the rising tide of revolt across North Africa, in Tunisia, in Egypt. Of course, labor unions played a central role. And many of the young activists that I've been in contact with from Tahrir Square themselves were expressing a rejection of neoliberal capitalism. How widespread is that? And do you think that as Egypt moves towards democracy, hopefully an honest democracy, that there's a possibility that we could get a government that is not so fully inscribed in the developmental models of neoliberal capitalism?
The majority of people in the Egyptian working class at the moment, actually, and it's a very interesting development, are actually putting demands through their strikes and sit-ins against privatization. Not only that, they want to renationalize a lot of the companies that have been privatized in the past 20 years by the Mubarak regime under pressure from the IMF and the World Bank. What's interesting is that a large section of the Egyptian working class, the young workers especially, have been doubly affected or harmed by these neoliberal reforms and attacks. Young workers are the ones who work on temp contracts, 3 months, 6 months contract. You're constantly getting fired and rehired, the lean market, so to speak, flexible labor policies. It's actually young people, many of them were in Tahrir, are the ones who suffered the most under those neoliberal policies. And there's a really widespread demand to end this temp contracts, to change the labor law, to go back to permanent status, job security, and to re-nationalize many of the public sector companies and factories. So in a sense, it is true. And I think it's still at the very early stages. It is, in one sense, a rebellion against neoliberalism, and it actually threatens in the months and years to come to go beyond a simple rebellion against the neoliberal scheme of the past 20, 25 years.
Mustafa Omar, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your work.
I'm Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States, and I'm here at the Left Forum in New York City with David Harvey. David Harvey, for decades, has been recognized as one of the world's leading theorists when it comes to geography and social space. And he is also one of the preeminent commentators and lecturers on the work of Karl Marx. The question I have for you at the beginning is pretty basic. If you look at the severe financial crisis that hit the United States, in many respects, this fits a classical paradigm where one would expect people would gravitate to a left political position, since the crimes of capital were largely exposed to people in ways that were never really more clear than they had been in their own lifetimes. You'd have to go back to the 1929, the Wall Street crash, and the Great Depression that followed. But in the years that followed, and there are a number of reasons, the popularity of Barack Obama, et cetera, there were not a lot of people actually gravitated to the left. But there also maybe were problems in that clear left positions weren't articulated very well. I'm wondering what you think Karl Marx would see, or yourself as an analyst of Karl Marx would see, in the absence of a powerful left formation, even in light of the recent crisis of capital in the domestic United States.
I think there are two aspects of this. One is that the traditional institutions by which the left organized, particularly the trade unions and the political parties, and I'm not merely talking about this country, I'm talking about, you know, communist and socialist parties in Europe and throughout Latin America and the like, that there's been an assault on trade unions and working class power, and also an assault upon those political parties. And the result of that is that the traditional means of resistance have been very much destroyed, I think. And it's therefore become very difficult to start to rebuild. In this country, for example, deindustrialization completely destroyed the sort of blue-collar working class. So when I went to Baltimore in 1969, there were 37,000 people employed in the steelworks. It's just disappeared entirely now. And even in the 1990s, it was producing roughly the same amount of steel with about 5,000 people. So we've had all those kinds of losses. And the imagination has not really been there to reconstruct on the part of working people under new circumstances. And the traditional trade union movement was not very innovative and not very responsive to the new conditions. I think that's one of the things that's beginning to change. We're beginning to see organizations of insecure workers and a different attitude emerging even within the traditional labor movement to try to reconstruct or build new institutions that can confront the nature of the crisis this time, which is different because we have this massive crisis no longer in the financial sector. It's really a crisis of employment. So that is one half of an answer to your question. The other half, the answer to the question, is that in academia, we've had an assault upon left-wing thinking in academia, and while it's not exactly been as bad as McCarthyism, certainly people like myself who have been teaching Marx all these years were increasingly marginalized, particularly in the 1990s, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And radical politics also became sort of really caught up in a new kind of radicalism, which was about, you know, fads in academia about post-structuralist this and that, and postmodern this and that, and of course a lot of identity politics, and therefore diminution within academia of interest in political economy and of interest in the notion of class. So you have very few academics really working on those questions. And this is, I think, the situation we are now in. And I kind of, when you look at the relationship between those two, I think the role of academics has always been to try to give some clarity to the practical work which is going on in social movements, be it the unions or be it, you know, urban social movements or whatever. And we haven't had people in academia doing that, and only now are those movements beginning to emerge. So we're at a beginning point, I think, of being able to rebuild on the left, but this rebuilding takes a little time. We need to train a new generation of graduate students who are very familiar with Marxian political economy, who are familiar with the notion of class analysis, not in a dogmatic, rigid kind of way, but in a way which is flexible and open to the new circumstances of the time.
I have two questions, one a follow-up, though, and maybe a thought or two on academic economics.
Well, academic economics, to me, has, in a way, become an exercise in futility. Now, there are heterodox economists around, and, you know, so I don't want to put them all in the same pot. But neoclassical economics has essentially failed. I mean, anybody who looked at the situation during this financial crisis and saw, you know, we have 11,000 academic economists in the United States, and hardly any of them had anything to say about what was going on. And when asked, you know, what's the problem, they kind of said, well, we missed something called systemic risk. Well, I would have thought that was the very thing that they should be looking at. It's a bit like, you know, turning to the engineers of the nuclear power station and say, well, we forgot about risk, you know, and you kind of go, this is crazy. So economics has not covered itself with glory, but of course they're deeply embedded in the power structures. So it's still the case that Obama, for example, kind of says, all my economists tell me, and you say, you're listening to Larry Summers and people like that. I mean, they're the people who created the problem. Why are you relying on them to get you out of the problem? So, but obviously economists are not going to give up their power position in relationship to those major institutions like corporations and so on, that employ them essentially in a way to sort of, and you know, Marx has this wonderful kind of thing where he talks about Nassau Senior, who kind of, and he says, well, he was a professor of political economy in Oxford, and he went to Manchester to learn the kind of economics he should teach, you know, from the cotton manufacturers, you know, and we pretty much have that sort of situation in conventional economics. And so, you know, it's not a total waste of time, but I have to say I'm very disillusioned with what economists have to say.
I suppose I have two different places that I want to go, and I want to bring things back ultimately to the domestic United States, because building a powerful left in the United States and the capacity of people to respond to the variety of crises and other general circumstances in American society to build a better society, and what maybe would be most poignant in your mind that can be taken from Marx and applied to the situation in the United States. But before I go there, I want to ask about global capital. And on the one hand, there was this huge crisis in finance capital that hit the United States. At the same time, there's incredible expansion of capital in developing countries, most conspicuously in China and in India. So to your mind, since there's such a degree of economic globalization, is there a contemporary crisis of capital?
Well, the financial aspects of the crisis were essentially solved, and I don't think, I mean, there are bits and pieces of problems around, but I don't think, I think that's been taken care of. It's been taken care of in a way which actually means that the losses have been socialized within the state apparatus. So now we're told there's a sovereign debt crisis, and the only answer to the debt crisis is austerity. But actually, that story has been around since the Reagan years. I mean, Reagan ran up the deficit massively over the arms race and the tax cuts. And David Stockman then kind of said, well, our plan was to increase the debt to such a level that we could then go after all the social programs we don't like. Bush Jr. did exactly the same thing, two unfunded wars, tax cuts to the rich, a big gift to Big Pharma on the Medicare prescription plan, and of course increased the debt. And Dick Cheney was always saying, Reagan taught us deficits don't matter. But then the Republican Party turns around and suddenly said, they do matter, and now is the point of the crisis where we can use the sovereign debt question to savage all of the social programs. And that seems to me is what's going on right now. It's a repeat of what they were trying to do in the Reagan years and didn't manage to get away, didn't manage to do completely, and were at the end game of that business. And that austerity, of course, and this was predictable, that it puts you on a collision course with the public sector union. So something like Wisconsin was almost bound to happen coming out of this. The only crazy thing is that they tried it in Wisconsin, which is the last place to do it, where you've got a capital building in the middle of a big university city with a left tradition, and you should have done it in Trenton, New Jersey, and then it wouldn't have been so spectacular. So that crisis is over. But from the Chinese standpoint, their problem, they're not interested in that agenda because their big problem is labor absorption. Because I think they're terrified of major labor unrest. And I think the only way they can make sure that doesn't happen is to absorb as much labor as they can. And when they got hit with the decline of the export industries and they lost about 3 million jobs in 2009, I think they were terrified of what might happen. So they launched this huge, huge investment program, which is rather like the interstate highway system was in this country, and a huge investment program, which mopped up a lot of labor. And at the same time, they turned to the banking sector and said, lend, lend, lend to anything that moves. And so what you've got is a huge lending program in China, some of it highly speculative. And if you look at property markets in China, they're doing what was really happening in property markets here in 2004. The property prices in Shanghai doubled last year, for example. And there's a vast kind of housing bubble developing and property bubble developing in China. And of course, one of the things that happens with an expansion program of that kind is you get inflation. And so there's an inflation problem in China. So the Chinese have a completely different kind of approach to what's going on, and they're not talking about the sovereign debt problem. They don't have it because, you know, they've got all the surpluses anyway, and they're using it to do this. And any country that's oriented to the China trade, like Australia with supplying it with minerals and Chile and so on, is expanding along with that. So China is in training and expansion in that part of the world. And independently, you have India also expanding very rapidly in this kind of circumstances. So you have half the world which is on a sort of very rapid development program with 8, 9, 10% rates of growth, and then this part of the world that's saying austerity, 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 which is going to condemn you to low rates of growth for as long as you keep that politics going. And the same is true in Europe, where actually, of course, you have a division. The one country that's really oriented to the China trade in Europe is Germany. And of course, they've revived, well, mainly in part upon the China trade. I mean, Greece doesn't export anything to China, so they can't revive. So you've got this division in Europe now between a part that's really surviving, partly out of the connection to the China thing, and the rest of it, which is in the doldrums. So you've got two parts of the world. One is growth-oriented and the other is not. But a lot of that has to do with this austerity mantra, which is about destroying the social wage and destroying wage levels even more than was done during sort of the 1980s, 1990s.
Which is hitting the domestic United States, yes. And which is being recognized by the general population.
Yes.
Obviously, even the Tea Party, part of their talking points over the past few years has included that. Throughout this series, we've heard a range of people suggesting strategies for reviving the left in the United States. Some economists calling for public works projects in the New Deal style, making them universal as opposed to temporary. We've obviously heard from people who talk about revitalizing labor, and then a whole bunch of other range of responses relating to specific issues, but many of them ecological and so on. What do you think, as someone who studies Marx as closely as you do, what would you point to as significant things to develop if we're to have a powerful movement towards greater economic justice and social justice in the United States?
I think we have to think across a number of different arenas of activity and action. One of the things I think we need to get away from, and the left has to, I think, be very clear about this, is that the idea of socialism or communism or whatever is not about state control. Now, there's been some very interesting polling about American attitudes over generations, and I think it's important to always bear these things in mind. Most Americans are very much in favor of a reasonably egalitarian economy. There was this survey that came out that kind of said, what do you think an ideal distribution of income would be? And people said, well, the top 20% should get 30% of the income. They were then asked, what do you think they get? And they said 60%. Well, actually, they get 85% of the income. So if you go on egalitarian line, you can get considerable mileage out of that. And I think the left should emphasize that they're about a much fairer distribution of income, and that is fundamental. The other thing that comes out of all of these surveys is that people are very distrustful of the state, and there's a great deal of hostility to state interventions. And what the right always does is to use that fear in order to prevent the egalitarian objective. You saw that in the healthcare debate. Nobody said we're against people having equal access to decent healthcare. Everybody says we're against state mandating or interfering in these choices and etc. So it was the anti-state rhetoric. And one of the things the left has to do is to say we are not necessarily about the state takeover of anything. In fact, Marx argued that if we want to overcome the capital-labor contradiction relation in production, we do it by having associated laborers, which is about worker control, autonomy stuff. And there are polls in the past, I remember, that showed that most people in the United States approve of that. Whereas if you kind of said we're about nationalization of the means of production, it all goes into the hands of the state, then, of course, you'll get a horrible response throughout the United States. So the left, I think, has to sort of look at those things and utilize them to kind of say, all right, we're about much more egalitarian reward structures, and we're also in favor of much more autonomy of choice in how labor is organized in the place of production. And you saw this when, for instance, Republic Windows, there was a tremendous kind of positive response on the part of the population. People said, yeah, that's great that they're doing it. So the left has to say, that's the kind of thing we want to do. And that's where we want to go. And that's what Marx had in mind. And that's what socialism is really all about, you know. So, and then I think you would have a different kind of politics emerging out of this. So I think there are ways to go politically, which fit into, if you like, the American ideology or the American culture, which is longstanding. I mean, these surveys show that these attitudes were there back in the 1930s. They're back there earlier, too. So if we can sort of say, recognize that and say, well, it's not about the state versus you. This is about associated workers deciding on things. And then, but out of this has come different models of organizing. For instance, in Europe, we have the example of Mondragon that showed that actually you can't have worker control of a factory without at the same time having access to credit. So they created credit institutions alongside of. So you would have the equivalent of what we have with credit unions being formed at the same time. So it's a different model of economic life and a different model of economic development, which is being proposed, can be proposed on the left. So I would argue that these things are very consistent with what Marx argues for. I mean, he never says we want to nationalize the means of production. He doesn't say that. He didn't say we should put credit in the hands of the state. But on the other hand, it's not about the state. So strategically, we have to go that way. And then I think the left would have much more sympathy with what its positions are about.
Right, indeed. And I think the U.S. steel workers actually are in dialogue with Mondragon about that strategy.
Yes, I gathered that. And Mondragon has been a very, you know, I think there are criticisms to be made of Mondragon. I don't think it's the paradise, you know, or anything like that. But on the other hand, the reward structure inside of a typical Mondragon apparatus is 3-1. The top gets 3 times as much as the lowest paid. And of course, in a typical U.S. corporation, it's something like 600-1. And if you kind of said, would you rather work in an enterprise where it was 3-1 or 600-1, I think most Americans would say, I'd rather work in 3-1 with some kind of worker power over decisions about investment and the like. And for example, worker power can be used in all sorts of ways. Even in Germany, where there's a considerable thing, there's worker power is used in the following way, that they can veto foreign investment if that foreign investment is going to take away jobs in Germany. So that Siemens, for example, has an agreement with its workers that it will not expand foreign investment, or it will have its foreign investment strategies vetoed by the worker representatives if those investments take away jobs from German workers. Now, imagine a situation in the United States where that kind of legislation went through. Then we'd be living in a very different world. The deindustrialization that went on and continues to go on would not be so easily worked. So worker power in relationship to corporate power within the corporation is, I think, it seems to me, a terribly important objective for the left to push for.
David Harvey, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm producer Melissa Figueroa with Building a Powerful Left in the United States, and I'm talking with Barbara Epstein. She's a professor in the History of Consciousness program at UC Santa Cruz. She's also the author of The Nonviolent Direct Action Movement, Political Protest and Cultural Revolution in the 1970s and 1980s, and most recently of The Minsk Ghetto, 1941 to 1943, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism. Now, Professor Epstein, as one who studies the relationship between culture, social movements, and the potential for political transformation and these transformative moments, where do you think you see us in this moment? I mean, we are in a moment of crisis, very severe and acute crisis, but also many also seem to believe that we are in a crisis of culture as well, that the way that both education, popular culture is not conducive to a raising of consciousness in the American populace about the nature of capitalism and how to confront it, or even if they can and should confront it. Is this what you see, or do you also see any kind of potentials for the formation of a powerful left social, cultural, political force in the United States?
Well, I think that the current economic crisis is at least as much an opportunity for the left as it is for the right. I think that the right has done a better job thus far of taking advantage of it, but I think that the left has, I think we have a much stronger argument than the right, and I think, you know, what we need to do is address the present crisis and make our argument to people. You know, I think for that to happen, we need to have a movement of the left that is dynamic and vibrant and capable of communicating to people. I think that's beginning to happen with what's been going on in Wisconsin, but I think that's just a beginning.
What do you see any differences or parallels between the movements in the 70s and, you know, in the 60s and the generations of today? There's also a lot of talk about how, you know, the old aesthetics of protests in that period is not relevant to this moment. But so what do you also see as perhaps both lessons we can bring from that generation, but also maybe spaces for new forms of organizing that we can see today?
Well, the movements of the 60s and early 70s took place in a period of prosperity, an extraordinary period of prosperity, actually. And I think we got used to the idea that we had the freedom to imagine whatever kind of society we wanted to imagine, and that we didn't need to, first of all, that we didn't need to worry about economic constraints. And now we do need to worry about economic constraints, but I think we also got used to the idea that a movement of the left would almost inevitably be a movement of middle-class young people and would not rest on the working class. And I think we're in a very different moment right now, that it's the working class, you know, along with other people, of course, who are experiencing the worst of this crisis. I think we have the opportunity, actually, at this moment, to speak to a much wider audience than was the case in the 1960s. But I think we need to address the way in which the economic crisis is hitting ordinary people.
And finally, in terms of policy prescriptions, you know, if you were the person to say, like, hey, look, this is what's happening, this is what we need to do, what would be your prescriptions for the movement at this time to build a powerful left?
Okay. Well, I think that there are three issues that are taking place simultaneously and are intersecting with each other. The first is the dramatically widening gap between the wealthy and everybody else. The second is the erosion, if not the destruction, of social services and the public arena, and with it, democracy. And the third is the environmental crisis. And all of these are driven by the profit motive. So I think that we need to address all three of them. And the way to address them is to demand reforms that we don't put in the hands of the corporations, but that we put in the hands of popular movements, state projects driven by and participated in by popular movements. In other words, we need to develop a set of demands that move away from the logic of capitalism and the logic of profit, and instead move towards a logic of common welfare and cooperation. I don't think that we can wait for the revolution to come in a thunderclap. I think instead we have to begin to develop what some people are calling entry projects, which are projects that move away from the kind of capitalist logic that has led to all of these problems and towards a different cooperative and, in our terms, socialist logic.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Barbara Epstein.
Thank you very much.
This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States from the Left Forum in New York City, and I'm joined by Glenn Ford, who is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Ralph Nader said at the top of this year that 2011, again, given the historic particularities of this moment, the economic crisis, and even perhaps the uprising in Egypt sparking people's imagination, and now there's Madison, Wisconsin to point to as well, that 2011 represented a unique opportunity for the left in the United States to articulate a transformative vision for the society. It would attract an audience, and this was the year to do it, because even if the economic situation was, there was no improvement there by 2012, everything will be focused upon the presidential election. The opportunity will be lost. So we're a few months into this year. Your sense of what kind of vision could be attractive to a broad population for a real progressive politics that could be transformative of American society?
Well, there are always opportunities. The left had an historic opportunity to go after the enemy, Wall Street, finance capital, the greatest danger to mankind that exists today. A great opportunity in 2008 with the meltdown. Things should have been seen in stark relief. We certainly saw it at Black Agenda Report as a watershed moment in human history, but they did not take advantage of that moment. 2011, prior to the race, I suppose we still have that opportunity. But if the pattern holds, as Ralph Nader said, if the pattern holds that by campaign time, which starts earlier and earlier, everybody gets back into that two-party lesser of two evils modality, then they won't take advantage of the opportunity. We'll see. What I'm seeing here is a lot of Obama supporters who are pretending that they weren't Obama supporters in 2008. I'm talking specifically about progressives for Obama. The left flank for Obama, which was designed to neutralize left criticism of this candidate. This is the first, 2008 was the first election that I have ever experienced, and I'm 61 years old, in which not one demand was made, not even a piddling little request was made of the Democratic candidate. The rule was, don't say anything or do anything that might embarrass or put in an awkward position this black candidate for president. If that pattern holds in 2011 going into 2012, well, that means the tragedy will just continue. The crisis will continue. That is the crisis, the neutralization of black politics. And when black politics, the constituency that is historically the most progressive in the country, when that branch of progressivism is neutralized, there is no hope of a real progressive movement in America. I used to do every 5 or 10 years a little survey to figure out for myself how much of the American electorate could reasonably be called progressive. And it usually came out to around 20%. And consistently, of course, half of that was black. So if we have a neutralized black community, you've knocked out half of the potential progressive movement in the country. And the most active and noisy and consistent half to boot. It's 2011 will be a very important year to see if we will see the cracks in black America, in Obama's support, widen, or if the wagons will be circled once again and he will be treated as the lesser of two evil who must be supported despite his betrayal of every element of the black historical political consensus.
And quickly, maybe in a checklist manner or not, a few central policy positions or even more general positions that you feel an honest left that is not a utopian left, but relates to the reality we live in, the type of things that you really feel should be supported by a general progressive community and are distinctly not endorsed right now by the Democratic Party as it operates in its day in, day out level.
Certainly humanity demands that the United States have a strong anti-war movement, that there be anti-war activity here in the belly of the beast, this unique position that we occupy. But you cannot have an anti-war movement that is anti-war in general, but does not say the name of the commander-in-chief who is conducting the wars. Until we have an anti-war movement that indicts Obama for his wars and the continuation of Bush's wars, it will be a farcical anti-war movement. We must recognize that Barack Obama is a servant of Wall Street. Remember that in 2008, when George Bush and his gang tried to push through a bailout of the banks, Bush failed. That effort was rescued 4 days later by the intervention of Barack Obama, who convinced many Democrats and most of the Congressional Black Caucus, which had initially voted against Bush's bailout, to support the new bailout. So we have to put Barack Obama right at the center of the Wall Street cabal that is now seeking to dismantle the American state and the developed states of Europe in the aftermath of their meltdown. These are critical times, and I do not see the American left measuring up to this challenge, but we shall see. We have to understand that the meltdown of 2008 was detonated by derivatives. In May of 2008, all of the social democrats of Europe, most of them out of work at the time, signed a letter posted in Le Monde, which is the French version of the New York Times, the paper of record, titled, "We Will Not Be Ruled by Mad Capital." And it was about derivatives and how they were atomic bombs hovering over the economies of the world. And basically, they predicted the meltdown. In the aftermath of the meltdown, there was huge public sentiment to abolish derivatives. 80% of the public wanted to see these bombs dismantled and diffused. But what did the Barack Obama administration do? It pushed through what it called a financial reform bill that specifically protected derivatives. And now the nominal value of derivatives is back to pre-meltdown levels, somewhere between $500 and $1,000 trillion. That's 10 to 20 times the value of the real world economy. This shows, it is proof in the numbers, that finance capital is disconnected from the world economy, represents a grave threat to the world economy. This is a crisis for them. Their response to this crisis after the meltdown is to mount a campaign to dismantle the governments that they built, their governments in Europe, that is the financial crisis in Europe, and in the United States. And that's what this austerity drive is all about, to privatize the public sector, to turn public assets into some fungible instruments that can be devoured by Wall Street, because it makes nothing, is now turned into a monster that, rather than encourage the productive forces of the world, not only holds back the expansion of humanity's productive forces, but preys on those forces and tries to dismantle them and commodify them and use them for capital purposes.
And again, it is a defensive battle, but the battle over against these austerity measures, it's certainly an opening for progressives, radicals, or anybody who has any sentiments towards social justice.
And I'm saying that it's not austerity, that really that's the wrong word. This is a raid by capital on the public assets. It is an effort to destroy the public sector so that everything can be bought and sold in society. The greatest prize is the U.S. public educational system, which is threatened not by the old Bush drive to hand out public vouchers to private schools, but to privatize the public school system itself through charterization so that the public continues to pay the costs of education, but the profits are made by private corporations. Boy, what better deal could a corporate guy think of than that? We pay the costs and they get the profits, and they also dictate the curriculum.
Glenn Ford, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thank you.
This is Alan Minsky from the Left Forum in New York City. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. We're going to close today's show with an excerpt from John Nichols' rousing speech at last night's closing plenary of the Left Forum 2011. Now, John Nichols of Madison, Wisconsin, and The Nation magazine.
Thank you. So, it is right that we recall and understand what is happening today in Libya. It is something that we cannot turn away from, even as we speak of other issues. And I will reference the words of an American president, an American Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, who said in 1821, "When America goes abroad searching for monsters to destroy, invariably we destroy democracy at home. Our military interventions, the violence that we send out from this country, comes back to haunt us, not merely in the blowback that a Chalmers Johnson might speak of, but in a diminution of we the people, in a diminution of our basic democratic institutions. No Congress declared a war on Libya. No American people rose up and said to drop those bombs. This is a moment in which we should be profoundly sad for what is being done, not merely to innocent people in a foreign land, but to our democracy at home." Let me also recognize that today at Quantico in Virginia, Daniel Ellsberg, one of America's great heroes, and dozens of others were arrested protesting the treatment of Private Bradley Manning. Like Ellsberg, I recognize the value of whistleblowers who make it their purpose to assure that the American people know what is done in their name, but without their informed consent. What our government has done in its treatment of Bradley Manning, no matter what his role in WikiLeaks, but what our government has done in its treatment of Bradley Manning and its attempts to silence WikiLeaks must be denounced by anyone who believes that we should have freedom of the press and a press that speaks truth to power. I am sad for Libya and for the Libyan people. I am sad for Bradley Manning and for those who love and know him. And we do recognize those sadnesses. But let us also allow ourselves a moment of joy, because I come from the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a Midwestern state, far from the East Coast and the West Coast, a place where there was always great farmer and labor traditions, a progressive movement of independent politics that rejected the Democratic and Republican parties, deeply rooted in the soil of our state and understood, taught in our schools. And we took that in. And the thing is that as we organized those early rallies, as people came to those events, we understood that we were in a moment of immense popular education. And that's a very important thing. We don't talk enough about that. You know, we think, and I know not people in this room, you're so smart and you're so good, but some people think that we get education from school or from a newspaper or from the news on TV. Well, let me tell you, I've seen something that will blow your mind. a 15-year-old kid with a bullhorn standing in front of 3,000 people at the capital of Wisconsin on a cold winter night saying, in 1887, the workers of Bayside, Wisconsin went into the streets, and recounting every bit of Wisconsin labor history, and the crowd listening and applauding and saying, this is who we are. We are labor radicals. We are progressives. We are farmer laborites, and we rise again against corporate power. When Governor Scott Walker announced his proposal, which I'm so glad we had these brilliant speakers before me, because they reminded us of neoliberalism and of, you know, all of these Thatcherite, Reaganite, and more contemporary line that there is no alternative, right? Thatcher's Tina. There is no alternative to corporate power, to an end to democracy, to an end to economic justice. We must accept corporate domination of everything that we know. They've told us so well about that. Well, Scott Walker brought that home to Wisconsin, and he brought home the fundamental underpinnings of it, which was a proposal to take away the collective bargaining rights of our unions, to break those unions, not merely as the voices of workers in the workplace, but also to break them as a political force arguing for a public sector, for a public space with public education where everyone has a right to services and has a right to knowledge. This was the assault that Governor Walker launched on our state. It is an assault that is being launched on every single state in this nation, and it is being waged at the federal level by Democrats and Republicans. When Governor Walker made this proposal, I was sitting with a friend of mine who's a very senior legislator. I'm a very distinguished pundit. And so we sat together and we spoke the truth that we knew, which was, there was nothing we could do about it. Power was going to prevail. Because, of course, we had had an election last November. A Republican governor and a Republican legislature had been elected. There was nothing we could do about it. It was going to happen. It was inevitable. We were smart. My friend's a politician. I'm a journalist. We know what is possible. But someone forgot to tell 50 students at the University of Wisconsin. And the next morning, they went out in front of the university's student union with signs that said, this shall not pass. This law shall not go into effect. The next day, about 1,000 students gathered, and they walked to the Capitol. And the next day, 2,000 students. And the next day, 8,000 students and people from the community, people from the community who knew it wasn't possible, but said, well, if the kids are out, I guess we'll go with them. And the next morning, that night actually, the teachers of Madison, my hometown, my 7-year-old's first grade teacher, walked off the job and said, we have an educational responsibility. We must go to the Capitol and educate our legislators about the necessity of public education. And 6,000 teachers and their fellow workers went to the Capitol. And as I went to cover that demonstration, I'm driving up the street in Madison going, oh, isn't this lovely? Isn't this interesting? Why? It's a little hard to get. I have a traffic problem here. I am concerned. I'm not moving as freely down this wide open boulevard as I should. What's slowing me down? And up ahead of me were 2,000 students from East High School, my mother's alma mater, walking 3 miles up the street to stand in solidarity with their teachers. Thousands of students who didn't take the day off, they went with their teachers. And the next day, 30,000 people. And the next day, 40,000. And the next day, 50,000. The Reverend Jesse Jackson standing outside saying, this is a King moment. This is a Gandhi moment. And inside the Capitol, Democratic legislators, weak, imperfect, believe me, I cover these people, not heroes, but they had a moment, an incredible moment, where they looked out the window and they saw 50,000 people outside, and they had to ask a fundamental question. Do we remain cogs in the machine of corporate power? Or do we pull ourselves out of that machine, walk out of the Capitol and deny the Republicans the quorum they need to pass this bill, and the Democratic members of the Wisconsin State Senate, not because they were courageous, but because they were scared of the tens of thousands in the street. They walked out of the Capitol, and they denied the Republicans the quorum. And let me tell you, folks, we're talking about a politics of solidarity. We always think solidarity is a nice thing, that somebody does it out of the warmth of their heart. You know, there's a solidarity based in fear of if you're not acting in solidarity that also has power, and that's what happened with those Democrats. So I'm going to close off here, though, with a notion of something that's very, I think, very important, because some people think that in a moment like this, we're supposed to come away with all sorts of complex lessons. Oh, every time people ask me, everybody asks me in the street, what's the end game? What's the end game? I always had a simple answer. The end game is we win. But the question is, how do we get there? Well, here's my answer, and it goes to the theme of this conference that we have been at, that all of you people, so many people in this room have contributed so mightily to. Here's the answer. The end game is solidarity. The end game is that act of unity with others. And I will tell you two very quick, I promise, Rod, I'm not going to go long. I will tell you two quick stories here. Number one, when the students and their allies, many of them influenced by the Seattle protests of 1999, chanting that slogan from Seattle, "This is what democracy looks like," occupied the Capitol. Thousands of people sleeping through the night in the capital of Wisconsin trying to delay the passage of this bill. When they did that, the governor went hysterical. He ordered them out. He ordered the police to remove them. He ordered all sorts of actions to get them out of there. And the police, trade unionists, I might add, kept saying, "Our job is to protect the physical safety of our community, but it is also to protect the rights of people to dissent." And the police did not remove the protesters from the Capitol. And yes. And there was a rumor that the governor was going to hire private security forces to remove the students from the Capitol. The Dane County Sheriff's deputies, police officers, uniformed police officers, marched into the Capitol at 7 at night with their sleeping bags, and they slept through the night in solidarity with those protesters. This drove the governor so crazy that he and his allies finally forced that bill through. They broke the law. They broke the open meetings laws. They violated the Constitution. They forced that bill through. And you know what happened? The next day, the New York Times, America's paper of record, reported that the fight in Wisconsin was over. It was done. The good guys had lost. We always lose. But somebody forgot to tell the people of Wisconsin. And last Saturday morning at about 9 o'clock, my daughter Whitman, who is 7, and I went down about 4 miles south of town. And we joined my friends Joel Greeno and Tony Schultz, farmers from out in western Wisconsin, and a lot of other farmers from around the state, one guy who had ridden his tractor for 7 hours since 3 a.m. to get there. And we gathered with the tractors, and we began rolling in to downtown Madison. We did not know what we would see, but the farmers had come to stand in solidarity with the workers. And these tractors rolled into town. We first saw a few people, a handful here or 4 or 5 there, little children with signs saying, "Thank you, farmers. Thank you for coming." And we rolled into the downtown. And as we got closer, cars slowed down and formed a corridor along to make sure that we were safe, that the tractors weren't, you know, driven to the side, that they could go through the lights and make it into downtown. By the time we got near downtown, there were thousands of people along the street. And as we came up that hill toward the capital of Wisconsin, 150,000 people had gathered in the streets to welcome the farmers and to welcome the workers of Wisconsin and to say, "We're sorry, New York Times. This struggle isn't over. We are coming back again and again and again and again. And we know that they will tell us that we must wait till the next election to make democracy real. But we recognize the wisdom of that First Amendment to our Constitution. It doesn't talk about elections. It doesn't even mention corporations. What it says is that you have a right to speech. You have a right to freedom of the press. And the most powerful right, our most forgotten right, we have a right to assemble and to petition for the redress of grievances. And I'm going to tell you this. There is only one lesson to take from Wisconsin. When they come for your rights, when they come for your unions, when they come for your possibility of economic justice and a just society, do not let anyone tell you to wait till the next election. Go to the streets. Fill the streets. Assemble and demand petition for the redress of grievances and do not back down. Solidarity!
Well, that's our show for today. If you're interested in capturing the spirit that John Nichols is talking about, KPFK is going to be at this Saturday's labor rally in downtown Los Angeles. I want to thank my co-host and co-producer, Melissa Figueroa. I'm Alan Minsky, and this has been Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum in New York City.